This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. When a child is diagnosed with autism, parents often feel overwhelmed and helpless, and they desperately seek support and guidance on how best to help their child. And professionals even feel perplexed by claims that certain kinds of treatments are the most effective or that others can even cure autism. Part of the problem is that traditionally autism is defined by deficits, difficulty social interactions, and repetitive movements, sensory challenges, and seemingly irrelevant and repetitive speech. Many approaches to dealing with autism say that these traits are societally unacceptable, and they try to eliminate them. But what if we instead tried to understand the experience of the person with autism? What if we started viewing these behaviors not as deviant, but as actually meaningful and purposeful actions that a person develops to cope and understand the world better? If we take on this perspective, we as parents can identify and build on the child's strengths and interests and offer the right kind of support, which naturally will lead to more desirable behavior and a better quality of life. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with one of the world's leading authorities on autism. This is a guy who's got more than 40 years of experience as a scholar, a researcher, and consultant, and he's got exactly the perspective that I'm talking about. We'll begin our conversation about a different way of looking at autism when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I walk and you drive. So let's make a deal. I'll watch for you and cross the street safely. You watch for me and stop. Think of the impact we can make.
A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Barry Prezant, who's the author of Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. Barry, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the difference between the way that you see autism and the way that it's generally presented. And I talked about this in the introduction that you didn't hear yet, but it's, you know, people tend to think about it as a series of things that are wrong. And you're looking at those as a series of things that are coping mechanisms in some way, it's much more subtle than that.
Yes, to a great extent. We talk a lot about the importance of asking the why question, or what I like to refer to as the deep why question, that when we look at patterns of behavior in children or older individuals with autism, so often in the past and still currently, they've been referred to as autistic behaviors. In other words, that they are the difficulty in and of themselves. That's the quote-unquote pathology that we see. And based upon our research, as well as my 40 years of experience, both myself and my colleagues really view a lot of so-called autistic behaviors as coping mechanisms, because what we're learning now from people with autism who could tell us about their experience is that the world so often is overwhelming, that stimulation is too intense, that people sometimes move too fast and talk too fast, and that causes a great deal of stress for them. So when we talk about so-called autistic behaviors, that may include everything from rocking to jumping up and down and flapping when very excited, to pacing back and forth, to staring at a wall or staring at one's own fingers. And we have been able to show in our work that that happens during times of great stress. And that's being validated now by what people with autism are telling us, but also very often parents understand that as well.
That raises the question, though, about whether it's conscious or not. And you seem to be saying that, that these behaviors are conscious and deliberate.
Well, what we are saying, not so much that they're conscious and deliberate. They could certainly be brought to that level where we might discuss with an individual, oh, you know, it seems that when you get a little bit nervous, you start rocking your body after it gets a little bit tense. But another very important point that we make in Uniquely Human is that these are human behaviors, that once we label them as autistic behaviors in some approaches, the whole way to deal with that is to try to get rid of the behaviors, is to try to, a term that's often used, is extinguish those behaviors. And we see them as, in many ways, a way to cope, and we have to begin that with that as the starting point. If the starting point is that, well, he seems to do, oh, licking his fingers, or he seems to really begin to pace or engage in a lot of self-talk, and self-talk is fairly common in autism, then we understand, well, maybe that's caused by confusion or stress, and we have to then decide as a team, and the team includes the parents, well, is it okay for him or her to do that? Is it such a big deal? Or if it is stigmatizing or it causes some problems, then maybe what we need to do is teach other coping strategies to replace those strategies rather than just saying we need to get rid of that.
Now, is there a way that you can define a little bit more finely the kinds of kids that you're talking about? Because, you know, the discussion has shifted. I think, you know, 10 years ago we were talking about autism, and then it's become now the autism spectrum. So there's a wide range. There are people who are just have a flat physical affect, what you, you know, Asperger's kind of a thing, and then some kids who are just profoundly not there in the way that we would like them to be there. So where are you on the spectrum as far as being able to actually have a productive conversation with a child about, hey, can we find some other ways for you to deal with this?
Yeah, that's an absolutely excellent question. And first of all, not only in my experience, but also in my book, Uniquely Human, we talk about the full range of individuals, those who would be considered to be most severely impacted by their autism, and those who would be considered to be on the milder end, even though you can ask many parents who have kids with Asperger's about, is that really mild autism? And they're going to chime in and say no. Because in many cases, because their children look so quote-unquote typical, it's more difficult for them and for people to understand them. So what's always been amazing to me is that sometimes you see the same patterns of behavior in the most challenged individuals as well as the individuals who are much, much more verbal and in some cases much more independent. The difference tends to be is that with self-awareness, individuals who are so-called more able are able to develop that ability to reflect on their own behavior, excuse me, and in some cases develop strategies because they know there are other things they can do. And that's a big part of our job, and I'm a speech-language pathologist by training, but a big part of our job as therapists and as educators and parents is to help a person be more aware of how their autism impacts them. I work a lot with, I have a lot of friends who are on the autism spectrum, and the ones who are doing the best in life are the ones who are most self-aware. Now, of course, that's more challenging for individuals, for example, who don't have a great deal of language. But the patterns of behavior that we see in the most challenged individuals as well as the more capable individuals, and they may be different in intensity and frequency that you see them, but in some cases the patterns are quite similar.
Talk a little bit about what echolalia is. Am I pronouncing that right?
Echolalia.
Echolalia, yes. Okay.
Yes. Echolalia is the tendency to repeat speech. And if you repeat it immediately, it's called immediate echolalia. So if I would say to you, do you want to go outside? And you go, do you want to go outside? It's immediate repetition of what I said. There's another form of echolalia that's called delayed echolalia, and this adds a little bit to the mystery of autism. Delayed echolalia is when a person or a child repeats things they had heard at a significantly earlier time, maybe the day before. It could have been weeks or months, and in my book I give an example of a young man who I hadn't seen in 10 years. And when he saw me, he started repeating things to me that I had said to him when I was teaching him. So he would say to me, as soon as he saw me, he would say, Barry, let's sit down. We're going to learn to tie our shoes. and I hadn't seen him in 10 years. So echolalia is related to the very typical excellent rote memory that we see in many individuals with autism. Now, I have both a personal and emotional investment, if you will, in echolalia, because that was the subject of my doctoral dissertation in the 1970s. And at the time, echolalia was considered to be meaningless parroting, I'm quoting now from the literature, psychotic speech, and it was considered to be a symptom of autism. It was an autistic behavior, and it was a behavior that was needed to be extinguished, punished in some cases. And even today, there are some approaches that if a child echoes what you say, you're supposed to say, no silly talk, or you're supposed to say, no talking. Yet we and other people following our initial research were able to prove that echolalia was a strategy for learning to communicate through speech and for learning to move into more creative language rather than just borrowing language that you hear from other people. But we can understand echolalia as an artifact of the learning style of people with autism, that people with autism have a different learning style than most typical people do. And that is, in part, related to a very, very good, strong rote memory and a very good visual memory as well. But echolalia is a reflection of very good auditory memory.
And that's something I think a lot of people who do not have autism or are not on the spectrum have different ways of learning. I mean, I know that if I see something, I'll have a particular kind of memory. If I see it and hear it at the same time, I'll have a better memory of it. If I hear it by itself, you know, there are different ways that we have. And so the idea that an autistic child would settle on seeing it or hearing it and then repeating it, actually not a bad idea. I mean, it's a strategy people use for remembering names at cocktail parties.
And thank you for saying that, because that was exactly the point and what we actually found in my doctoral dissertation. And then we did a later study on delayed echolalia. And it gets back to the title of my book, Uniquely Human, that what the point we make is that these are human behaviors. By training, I'm a student of child language development and social and cognitive development. So what I've written extensively about is how echolalia is similar to what we see in some typical kids, but not the majority of typical kids. It's an extreme form of a language learning style that you do see in some typically developing kids. The difference is that with typically developing kids, they move through these stages so rapidly, sometimes over, you know, a few months or a year when they're very, very young, that we don't really notice it. And they're also using language creatively simultaneously. With kids with autism, their style tends to be skewed more towards what we call the gestalt language learning style. And so the uniquely human piece of that is, wait a second, we do see this in all human beings, in typically developing kids, but the difference in autism is it may last longer and it may take much longer for them to move through those stages of echolalia.
Talking with Barry Prezant, who's the author of Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Barry. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Barry Prezant, who's the author of Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. And we're just talking about echoing and using that as a strategy. Talk about a little bit about moving into the idea of living with autism. I guess trying to understand this from the child's perspective. How do they understand what they're going through or what they're experiencing?
Yes, well, you know, fortunately, we're in a very different place now than we were 15, 20, 25 years ago. And that is primarily due to the fact that there are so many people with autism now who could share their experience. You know, when Temple Grandin was the first one to do that, and of course, Temple is a very well-known animal scientist and expert in autism, she was the first person to come forth and say, I have autism, and let me tell you what life is like for me. And that was in the mid-1980s or so. And everybody always depended upon Temple as the person who could describe what it's like to have autism. And now there are literally hundreds of people with autism speaking at conferences on the internet. I just a few weeks ago attended the Autism Society of America National Conference, and I've never seen so many people with autism actively participating, giving sessions, responding in talks that I was giving with wonderful points they were making. So first of all, it's very important to note that one person's experience with autism is one person's experience, that people with autism can be in some ways as different from each other as you are from me. So you can't necessarily say because this person with autism experiences the world this way, all people do. But yet there are commonalities that we can learn from. One of the commonalities is the sensory experiences, that many people with autism are highly sensitive to sound, to touch, and in some cases, there's a group of people who are undersensitive to sound, to touch. Those are the people who might appear more lethargic and not so focused, where a person who's highly, or what's called hypersensitive, those are the people that might have much, much more difficulty going out into busy environments or noisy rooms because it's overwhelming to them. And then another commonality is that we know many people with autism have difficulty kind of understanding the nuances of social interaction. And that could be everything from a more challenged individual who has problems watching people and getting information by watching people, to your most capable people who are confused by language that, for example, is sarcastic or cynical. Some of these little social nuances that over many, many years of learning that we all learn to be able to respond to and to understand. So it really varies greatly what the experience of a person with autism is, but what I always say is we need to listen to people with autism now. And I've been so fortunate in that not only have I gotten to know people, but I've presented workshops with a number of different people with autism. And I just soak in all that information, and it's so, so helpful for me. And, you know, in my book, Uniquely Human, I have a whole chapter on a few specific people with autism who I've gotten to know really well, who've become friends, and what I've learned from them.
I wonder how successful it is to teach behavior to kids with autism. And I'm thinking of a girl that I talked about it a while ago, who was a classmate of my older child, who's now 25. So this is happening a long time ago. And I remember taking my daughter to this girl's birthday. And she was standing by the front door greeting everybody who came in. And she said, "Hi, Jenny, I like your dress." And then the next girl would come in and she'd say, "Hi, you know, Josie, I like your dress." And it was the exact same thing to every girl. And it was clear that somebody had said, okay, look, if you want to get along better with other people, if you want to interact with other people, you have to say something nice to them. That's a good way to engage in, which is a wonderful lesson, I think. But she wasn't getting it. I think she was just repeating the phrase without really understanding what it was all about.
This is a really good example of whether we could look at the cup half full or look at the cup half empty. If we want to look at the cup half empty, we might say, oh, it's just a little bit of a rote phrase, and, you know, that's all it is, and maybe she doesn't understand it exactly as you just said. If we want to look at the cup half full, maybe here's a child who never greeted friends before, and that this is a starting point, and she was probably a little bit nervous. We use the term emotionally dysregulated, and one of the things that we see in people with autism is they tend to come out with their rote strategies. And if you think of it, it's a strategy that works. She's still greeting people, and that's a heck of a lot better than not greeting people when they're coming to your birthday party. So I would also assume that this young girl, if she was under a less stressful circumstance, she might be able to greet people and acknowledge them by their appropriate name rather than calling everybody Jenny. Again, that's just another good example of, you know, how do we look at behavior in autism? So this young girl's mother might have been thrilled that she greeted every child coming in, and the fact that she didn't get the names right, not a big deal. And that mom would know that under a similar circumstance 2 years before, maybe she would have run the other way, or maybe she wouldn't even have come out of her bedroom because she was so anxious.
So, Barry, where were these kids 20 years ago or 30 years ago? Because I remember, I know that autism is becoming more commonly diagnosed, and it's for a variety of reasons. We don't need to talk about that, but it's more common than it was. But I mean, were kids like this, kids with autism, the kinds that you're describing, who have these rocking behaviors and different kinds of behaviors that are not quite socially acceptable, I mean, were they institutionalized? Were all the people who are speaking at conferences not, what happened to them? Where were they?
Well, I think certainly, and the research actually supports this, is that a certain number of these kids were given other diagnoses. And there's a term for that called diagnostic substitution. If these individuals, unfortunately, had additional mental health issues as opposed to the developmental disability of autism, such as depression, such as maybe behavior that was considered to be very aggressive because they felt very, very challenged in their lives, that people with those significant problem behaviors would much more likely been institutionalized. What's very interesting is in the history of institutionalization, the most common factor that would lead to that would be extreme problem behaviors, either self-injurious behavior when you hurt yourself or when you hurt others. Not so much intelligence, but those kind of problem behaviors. One of my dear friends and colleagues who is a well-known person with Asperger's, one of the quotes that I learned the most from him, his name is Michael John Carley, and Michael says, when you meet a person with autism, they are more an artifact, if you will, or a product of their life's experiences than they are of their autism. So that's one of the major concerns right now, especially once we move into adolescence and adulthood, is mental health issues that some people with autism, you know, may experience. And that could be everything from alcoholism to drug addiction to severe depression to suicidal tendencies, largely due to the stresses that they experienced in life. Let me give a plug to a new friend of mine. His name is Steve Silberman. And he has a book that's coming out the end of this month, the end of August, and it's called Neurotribes. And it's basically a history of autism going back centuries. And he makes the argument that people with autism were always here. If they learned a skill or had an ability that society accepted and valued, they would be considered kind of eccentric, reclusive geniuses. But he feels, and many people feel, that yes, there is an increase in autism, but it's not this epidemic that everybody's talking about. It's just that we looked at the kids differently. And certainly, the more capable people with autism, many of whom got the Asperger's diagnosis before that was struck from the DSM criteria last year,
right.
That those people were always here and have contributed to society in wonderful ways. But because they had skills that society valued, that they were not thought of as, if you will, needing a diagnosis of autism. They were just thought of as different.
Barry, we only have just a minute. I want to just have you tackle one quick thing.
Sure.
Do you worry that you might be giving people false hope that they can cure this? And I know that cure is probably not a word that you're using because you're looking at the symptoms very differently, but a lot of people still would probably think of needing to do something about this.
Yeah, actually the message in Uniquely Human is not about cure. We actually say the opposite, that parents should not be putting all of their energy, both their psychic, emotional energy and their monetary energy, into trying to cure their child. That certainly there are many ways to support their child in everyday activities with the help and guidance of professionals, but the whole notion of cure and recovery from autism, yes, there are a small number of kids who move off the spectrum. I've known kids like that. Are they cured? I wouldn't say they're cured. They still have some challenges. But their challenges are mild enough that they no longer meet the diagnosis of autism. So our message isn't about cure or recovery. It's about supporting kids and families to make the best progress and really reach their potential, and trying to take some of the burden off the families of thinking that they have to totally turn their lives upside down to help their child. They could help their child in a lot of ways and still find balance in life, and that's very important to the family.
Barry Prezant, the author of Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. Barry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Arne.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Want to jump right into this week's Mr. Dad column. Dear Mr. Dad, my husband and I are new parents, and our baby is going to have his first birthday in a few weeks. We both work in tech, and we're really excited about getting a tablet for him. There seem to be so many options out there, and we're a little overwhelmed. Should we get an iPad, or is there a better choice for toddlers? Yes, the internet is full of videos of very young children happily swiping away on their tablets, but the best tablet for your baby is no tablet at all, at least not for a while. In fact, if I had to recommend one toy that's an absolute must-have for babies, it would be a nice set of blocks. But before I tell you why blocks are so good, let's talk about some of the reasons why tablets are such a poor choice for babies. First of all, the more time a baby spends interacting with a screen, the less time he'll spend interacting with live humans, which is a lot more important. Tablets are great for a lot of things, but they cannot teach verbal or social skills. Although research on babies and tablets is in its infancy, so to speak, early results aren't very pretty. Researchers and daycare providers, for that matter, are finding that toddlers who spend a lot of time playing with tablets are developmentally lagging in terms of muscle tone and hand-eye coordination. Swiping takes a lot less dexterity and coordination than stacking blocks or picking up tiny objects. One app company, Tigly, has taken some excellent steps to bridge the gap between swiping and developing actual fine motor skills, but the rest of the industry has a long, long way to go. As kids get older, screen time is associated with weight gain, behavior problems, repetitive stress injuries, sleep problems, and low cognitive performance. Okay, so what's so great about blocks? To start with, they help your baby develop hand-eye coordination as well as grasping and releasing skills. They teach your baby all about patterns, sizes, and categories, things like the big ones go with the big ones, the little ones go with the little ones, gravity and balance and structure. These mini lessons in math and physics lay the foundation for your baby's later understanding of how the whole world works. They teach good thinking skills. Here's a great quote from Albert Einstein, a guy who knew a thing or two about thinking. Taken from a psychological viewpoint, this combinatory play seems to be the essential feature in productive thought. Before there is any connection with logical construction in words or other kinds of signs which can be communicated to others. Blocks can help your baby grasp the difference between things he has control over, such as which blocks he wants to use and how many he wants to stack on top of each other, and things he doesn't, such as the law of gravity, which keeps knocking down those towers. Blocks teach perseverance. Building a tower or anything else out of blocks can be excruciatingly frustrating for a baby, but along the way, he'll learn that if he keeps working on something long enough, he'll eventually succeed. Research by Dimitri Christakis and his colleagues at the University of Washington found that kids who play with blocks have better language skills and watch a lot less TV than those who don't. Finally, the best thing about blocks is that they encourage parents to get down on their hands and knees and spend time with their children, playing, laughing, and learning. We'll be back next week with another Ask Mr. Dad segment or a Parents at Play segment. Hey, but don't go away quite yet. There's a lot more positive parenting to come. I'm Armin Brott.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey, is that a faucet running?
Nope. That's not a faucet. That's a river rushing through the forest.
It is?
Yeah. Forest rivers provide over 100 million people with clean water to drink. The water comes straight from the forest to us. In fact...
What? I can't hear you because of the vacuum.
That's not a vacuum. That's the trees in the forest cleaning up the air we breathe.
How do trees clean the air?
They soak up the dirty air on their leaves, branches, and trunks, which means clean air for us.
Hmm. Cool. I didn't know that.
Yep. But the forest does more than give us clean air and water. It gives us shade for hot days, birds to listen to, and trees to climb.
Wow, that's awesome. I didn't know how cool the forest could be. Hey, let's go explore some more.
Visit the forest today and enjoy all it does, just for you. To learn more about the forest and find one near you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. You know, not that long ago, there were four women, four friends, two of whom were childhood educators, and they became grandmothers within just a few years of each other. Just as they had shared so much as mothers, they now began sharing their experiences with each other as grandmothers. And the best part was the exchange of ideas for fun activities with the new family members, games to play and songs to sing, books to read, places to go with young grandchildren. Time passed, and they continued collecting ideas, often being asked by other friends things like, what book or toy would a three-year-old like? What were the words to that marching song? And how do you make Play-Doh? The four women kept track of their ideas on index cards and scribbled notes, and they wrote down about their favorite lullabies and books and toys and simple art projects. Over time, it grew and it grew and it grew. 22 grandchildren later, they now have put all of that wisdom together in a new book. And in this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with three of the four authors about all of that, about grandmotherhood, about where they got their ideas, about what works and what doesn't work, and about a lot of other things as well. They've done all of the research on child development for us. They've tested all the activities, and they've got a lot of practical advice on the kind of equipment you're going to need. We'll start talking about grandmotherhood and a lot more when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every five children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guests for this part of the show are Jan Eby, Lori Mobilio, and Lynn Noel, who are three of the four authors of the Grammy Guide, Activities and Answers for Grandparenting Today. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
All right, so let's start at the beginning. You rarely have four authors on a book who at least are able to maintain some sort of speaking friendship after the whole thing is done. And you three obviously have... You're friends. You have a great little, you know, interaction between each other, and you came here all together. How did that work? How did you happen to get together and decide to work on a book all at the same time?
Oh, I'll take that one. This is Lynn. We had raised our children together, Armin, long ago, and then suddenly we were becoming grandparents at about the same time. And just as we had shared experiences raising our children and having fun with them, we decided, you know, maybe we should share some ideas about what we're doing with these new little grandbabies in the family. And two of us are early childhood educators, and we'd had a little more experience with early childhood education, but the other two also have had a lot of experience with young children, and we went looking for a resource book for grandparents, and because we were just going to use the ideas to exchange among ourselves as friends. As we looked around, there was no book that had exactly what we wanted, which was the developmental information of the milestones in early childhood, as well as lots of fun things to do with young children that were screen-free. So as we were sharing ideas together and finding that our friends were asking us for ideas, we thought, well, we'll write them down. We'll write them for ourselves. We'll enjoy sharing them with our friends. And suddenly, well, why don't we just write the book that we wish was out there? That's how it happened.
That's great.
An answer to your question as to how we remained friends
and
through
this
the
is
challenge.
Laurie.
This is Laurie.
Just so we know. Okay. We
began as very good friends, and before we even wrote the book, we decided to each one of us write a paragraph on what we wanted this book to be, to make sure we had a similar philosophy. And our philosophy in writing the book was very similar, and throughout an editor told us we would likely not remain friends, that there was a danger of falling apart, but we proved her wrong.
We did. And she admitted it.
She did.
And Jan, have you got a different take on this?
We had a good time doing it, and I think the fact that there were four of us kept us at it. If someone felt a little lagging behind, we kept up because of the group effort. Our husbands at some point said, really, you're still writing that book? I think you just want to get together. But we were pretty serious at our meetings directed toward the book.
So there really is all sorts of great stuff in here. We'll talk about as much of it as we can. But at least two of you were educators, and you spent a lot of time in schools with young children.
Yes.
So you had some sense of activities already that would be good to do. How did you get something that you'd learned about in theory and you've done in a classroom situation? How does that apply necessarily to real life?
Well, because Lynn and I, this is Jan, we were preschool teachers. We had been elementary school teachers also, but in more recent years, preschool teachers. We saw the types of activities that were used in our schools that the children loved, the basic things. We had also dealt with parents and had parts in parent education. And so that was one of the reasons others would ask us about those little jingles and songs because they couldn't remember them from when they raised their own children. And they were right on top in our minds because we were doing it weekly.
Right. Just to add to that, this is Lynn again. The schools that Jan and I were affiliated with were parent participation schools, play-based schools. So we were not interested in teaching academics to young children. We wanted them to have very developmental fun things to do, and we knew that all our friends who were extremely eager to be the best Grammy ever just needed a resource to remind them of what those things might be.
You know, it seems that you start the book off with something that I rarely see in grandparents' homes, and I haven't been in tons of them, but I've been in a number of them, and which is childproofing. And I think that's such a fantastic idea because, you know, we all, as parents anyway, you childproof the heck out of your house and you crawl around on your hands and knees and you look at all the things that look like attractive nooses, you know, that kids are going to try to strangle themselves with. But when they go to Grandma and Grandpa's house, it's not always the same. And you still have the little kid who's learning to walk if you've got a baby who's like that who can slam into the corner of something. So how is the process of childproofing, or is it any different from the way that it might be as a parent?
This is Laurie. I don't think it's all that different. It's a matter of making your home child-friendly. And for some grandparents, they may not want to scour their entire house and make every room child-friendly, but they should be aware of particular dangers. And so any of the rooms that children will be playing in need to be carefully monitored, and it's everything from electric plugs that are too close to little ones crawling around to grandma's purse who's left on the chair for little ones to explore. So
well, and there may be some medication in that purse,
exactly.
Yes,
because of ages. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Were you going to say something?
Correct.
John?
Well, and the pennies in the sofa, you know,
oh,
and
yeah.
things you don't think
yeah.
of. So one of the little tricks we suggest is getting down on your hands and knees, if you can, and taking a look around it. What is it in your house that might be enticing to a child, and what are they seeing mm-hmm. at their level?
Now, what about the aesthetics of it? I mean, if you're a parent of a young child, everybody expects that you're going to have Lego all over the place and you're going to have these ugly-looking things on the corners of your furniture. Grandparents don't necessarily want to have that, right? I mean, you don't want to have raising a child be your primary identity. So how do you deal with that? I mean, you have friends who are coming over who may have grandchildren. They may not have grandchildren, but they may say, well, the house looks terrible. You've got all these bubble wrap on everything. This is not any way to be.
This is Lynn. I think many grandparents that we know would love to brag that they did have grandchildren over and the house looked this way. But we do suggest that there might be a room or two, as Laurie mentioned earlier, that you have be the playroom for the child, or you do have a big drawer or closet where you keep the toys that when they come over, they know that's where they are, and they help you put them back. There's nothing wrong with them being part of that part of the play is putting things away also. But I think what we have found in the grandparents that we know is that they're more than delighted to let the house be messy for that one bit of time or that one day a week or for that one week in a month, whatever the length of time is that a visiting grandchild will be there, and have that room be safe and secure for the play.
How does being a grandmother, I guess, how does it affect your relationship with your child, not the grandchild? And excuse me, the reason why I'm asking is because I do a lot of work with fathers, and I often hear that you know, the father brings his child over to the grandfather, and it tends to be the same-sex parent. And he says, where was all this when I was growing up? I mean, all these things you've got, all these activities and the singing and the art projects and stuff. I mean, come on. It seems unfair. I mean, obviously, circumstances have changed and everything, but there is that. And I'm wondering, so how in particular with your kids and daughters especially, or daughters-in-law, how do you react to that if there is that kind of a dynamic?
Go ahead.
I'll take it as a starter. This is Lynn again. I think in our book and certainly in our own lives, we've made it our silent rule that those are the parents and we are the grandparents and they make the major decisions. But we do hope that when they're with us and that we've worked closely enough with those parents to be sure that the things we're doing with them are not to rival what mom or dad may have planned, but just to augment and offer the things that maybe mom and dad just didn't have time for when they were growing up to do with them and maybe don't have time right now to do with their grandchildren.
Right.
So I think the number one rule is to certainly not criticize anything mom or dad are doing and talk over with them if you think you're offering the circus. But the things that we suggest in the book are not so awesome, wonderful. They're just plain, fun, easy, easy to engineer games, toys, and activities.
I was not actually talking about that part of it.
I'll talk
about that part of it later. It was really mostly the dynamic between you and the child, about the child who may feel somehow that you're doing it right now and you weren't doing it right, you know, when I was a kid. But I'm going to have to finish that story in just a minute because we're going to have to take a quick break. I'm talking with Lynn Noel, Laurie Mobilio, and Jan Eby, who are the co-authors of the Grammy Guide, Activities and Answers for Grandparenting Today. We'll pick up right where we left off when we get back. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
Ever notice when you have a baby, everyone seems to give you advice? From your mother-in-law, to your own parents, to your friends. But when it comes to the important stuff, like immunizations and protecting my baby's health, I trust my baby's doctor. She really listens to my questions about shots, gives me great information, and she works with me to make sure my baby gets protected. And that's something even my mother-in-law can agree with.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jan Eby, Laurie Mobilio, and Lynn Noel, who are three of the four co-authors of the Grammy Guide, Activities and Answers for Grandparenting Today. Just before the break, I was asking you about the dynamic between the grandparent and the adult child. And I was thinking of one specific experience that I have with my dad. I remember walking in at one point and seeing him with my two older daughters. And he had taken a poster off of the wall, and it was a poster of some scene with the Last Supper in it. And he has covered it with saran wrap. And he's drawing, and he's showing the kids the perspective about how things are. There's a triangle shape here, and you can see that the way that the characters are laid out. And I think I never got an art lesson like that.
This is Laurie. It is interesting. I think we at least grew up in a different era where fathers in particular were not very involved in our upbringing. And we make the point in our chapter for grandfathers that this is their chance to get really involved in having fun with preschoolers. And we hope that the relationship is strong enough between parent and this adult child and parent that there's no jealousy, but pure enjoyment in seeing the bond between across these generations.
Let's talk about something that, for better or worse, happens, and I guess it happens, probably didn't happen as much when you were kids, or when I was a kid, for that matter. It seems like grandparents were closer by. So now you've got people living thousands of miles away, or even hundreds of miles away, or maybe even not even that far, but somebody's in a nursing home and can't get out and can't be connect in the same way. So how do you help grandparents connect with the grandkids and have some sort of a meaningful relationship over time and distance?
Well, the three of us have that situation. Some of our grandchildren are not nearby, so we have given that a lot of thought. In fact, have a chapter in the book about it. It's important to enlist the help of the grandchildren's parents. If they can be encouraged to keep pictures of you around, to allow phone calls, and the one high-tech thing, Skyping, has been popular for grandparents nowadays to be actually able to visit and see each other. Of course, if you can visit back and forth, making it a special time, and maybe creating some traditions that are repeated each time so the child can build on that memory.
So I want to ask you about something. We'll get back to this in a second, but just the hit me, and I hope none of you have had to deal with this, but I hear about this every once in a while from the perspective of the parent, not the grandparent. There's a divorce in the family, and grandparents can sometimes get lost in the divorce, that if there's particularly a lot of hostility between the parents, that, you know, the whole thing, the parents, the in-laws, everybody's on the blacklist. How do you help grandparents stay in touch in that kind of a situation? Anybody got to tackle that one?
I'd be happy to try. This is Lynn again. That would be a difficult situation, and thankfully I haven't had to experience that, but I do have friends who have. Again, I think, as Jan mentioned earlier, keeping in touch with the grandchild then will be on you, and it will be using lots of opportunities with the mail to send them stickers when they're little, or little greeting mm-hmm. cards or reminders or postcards from where you're visiting. Maybe you won't have the support of the parent, and so you'll have to find ways yourself of somehow creating that communication. I think it would be extremely difficult, and I think that's an area that we did not deal with much in our book, but it is certainly one that parents are dealing with now.
So, Lori, you're about to jump in, it
looks like. I too, have not faced that particular situation of a divorce, but I did lose my son, and so I was left with a wonderful daughter-in-law and my grandchild, and we have both of us worked very hard on maintaining the relationship and have very successfully done so. I think it can be done as long as you do not interfere or try to dominate or try mm-hmm. to make divisive comments, but to focus on what's best for the child and for the children. So I think that's the focus that grandparents
okay.
need
no,
to take.
Fair enough. Yeah. It just struck me as something yeah. that mm-hmm. comes. I mean, I hear about it. It comes up a lot. And then not everybody appreciates the importance of a grandchild yeah. or a grandparent in the grandchild's life. And right. when you've got all of a sudden no Thanksgivings together anymore, it's mm-hmm. it can mm-hmm. can change quite a bit. And mm-hmm. and I actually would wonder about if your daughter-in-law gets remarried.
She did.
And
to a wonderful
there we go.
Guy.
Okay.
and they have since had another child. And in fact, I just drove in this morning from having visited them last night. So I have another grandchild, Brock. So Brock and Luke in the same family. So I have been very fortunate in how open they have been to maintaining the relationship
Great.
With me and my husband.
All right, so let's get back to some cheerier things. setting up a house for art projects and things like that, what's the best way to do that?
Well, the kitchen is often a very good place for things like that with very young children. You can play with water in the sink. You can use your countertop with a plastic covering for messy, smeary shaving cream or paint or scooping rice. a garage floor, as long as it's a supervised area, because there are a lot of dangers in a garage, can be good, or the deck outside. It is nice to have things in containers that you can put things away and pull them out again, and have a little bit of a high overlook because accidents happen.
Well, sure. They do. Yeah. And I just forgot what I was going to say. You have different age that you talk about in the book, and different activities for different ages. Do you think that there's a harder age or a hardest age for grandparents to deal with?
Teens. And our book isn't about that. No. You know, I think for me, none of them was a difficult age. I think each one, though, has its own joys and stresses. It's harder in a way to relate to an infant, because in those early months, they're barely aware of who you are. And as grandparents, we like feedback. We want the smile. We want the little, oh, I recognize you, or mom, Nana, or they're going to call you, whatever they would call you. So it might be a little more challenging to start off. But on the other hand, in our book, we talk about the many ways that you can do very simple things to begin to build that bond if you see them regularly, if you see them frequently.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, because we talked a lot about the doing part of stuff, you know, art or watching movies or just childproofing or something like that. But there's also the just the relationship, and you hear so many people talk about how close they were to their grandmother or grandfather. And how does that relationship start building? I mean, how do you go from doing an art project to becoming the confidant and becoming somebody who can give advice and somebody they can come to? And, you know, because you're a different sort of a person. They're having horrible problems at home with the teen years, and they hate their mother, they hate their father, but you, they can talk to.
It's something, this is Laurie again, it's something that we challenge our audiences to think about. You know, how do you remember your own grandparents? And usually it's doing very simple things like picking up the mail or taking out the garbage or baking cookies or learning how to operate a camera. It's not the grand and glorious effort that are made. It's just having that one single person they can count on in their lives who can slow down and really listen and be involved in that one-on-one activity that parents may not have the luxury of time to indulge.
And one of the very beginning ways to do that is to sit with the child and read. I mean, there's just nothing more wonderful than having them on your lap or next to you and taking the time that little children really love with a book to go again and again over the story. And that builds. And just the feeling that I think young children get if you allow them to have that one-on-one time of grandma or grandpa really like me, really care mm-hmm. for me. You're not judgmental. We're in a different position than a parent is. We play and they go home and they feel they've had a wonderful, okay. loving time.
And so just the last question, because we're pretty much out of time, but I want to just get a little bit of this, an idea from this. What if you really strongly disagree with something that your child is doing and you want to give them advice on what you think that they ought to be doing instead? And I know you mentioned before about you defer to them, but it's got to be hard to bite your tongue.
You're talking about the adults, the parents.
Yes,
the
child,
yes.
Not the grandchild. Yeah,
yes.
Laurie, so you were saying something about that before.
I don't think that I strongly disagree with what they are doing. It's what the world is doing around them. At the time pressure on parents right now, so that they can't take the time that they want or may want to do these things that we're suggesting grandparents can do, I don't fault them for it. I think especially living as we do in the Bay Area of San Francisco, where people are just terribly, terribly busy, I wouldn't fault my own children for being so busy, but they are, and the children are overscheduled because those parents are busy and they need to keep the children busy. That would be my answer.
My guests have been Jan Eby, Laurie Mobilio, and Lynn Noel, co-authors of The Grammy Guide, Activities and Answers for Grandparenting Today. Thanks very much for coming in. Great to have you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.